everyone. What I'm going to talk about mainly is about the settlements and the various Israeli policies and how Israel goes about doing the violations it does under a legal context. Si vous voulez demander en français, je parle français assez bien, alors c'est si vous voulez. Anyway, so basically what our research institute does is it does applied research on the West Bank and Gaza Strip. We monitor the changes on the ground that happen, and this is how we deal with the settlements. It's just a small section of what we do, and that's my job. So we have satellite images, aerial photos, field work, data, in order to assess and monitor how these changes, first what these changes are, and how these changes affect the Palestinian society. We have been doing this for the last 10 years, and I dare to say that we have become like a resource center in this field in ourselves. You can see our website is www.arij.org, A-R-I-J.org. It's the third one. I'm going to just directly start off from the 1967 war, since most of us know the story. The main point about the 67 war is that the international community recognized Israel within the 1948 areas. Okay, what happened in 1967 is that Israel occupied further land and also the Sinai and the Golan. So according to international law, all of these areas are occupied territories. Okay, Israel has no, or the international community does not recognize any Israeli sovereignty over all of these parts, including East Jerusalem. This is a common misconception that people have. People think that Jerusalem has always been under Israeli control and all that. So this is one of the things. Even the United States of America does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over East Jerusalem, regardless of its official policy in the world. Its laws still do not recognize Israeli sovereignty on East Jerusalem. Being an occupying power, this entails certain duties and rights for the occupying power. First of which is the fact that there is a tenet in the international law that says that it's inadmissible to acquire land through war. Regardless if it is your land or it's not your land, if you're contending that it is yours, still acquiring it through military means does not give you any... we call it de jure or legal sovereignty by law. You don't have any sovereignty by law. You have sovereignty by force, by fact, by fait accompli, that you are there, you are the powerful entity there, but it's not legally yours. So what you can do there, and this is according to international law, is basically... It gives some rights to the occupying power in the sense that it can do things that have to do with the state's security. That is, it can put military bases, it can initiate some laws, but they have to be laws that, first of all, are of temporary nature, and second, they have to be not to the disadvantage of the indigenous population. These are two very important principles of international law when it comes to occupying power's rights. So, Israel can, under international law, have military bases, have a military government that sustains law and order in the occupied territories, but it may not do things that are eternal or of not a temporary nature, like building settlements or like having cemeteries in the West Bank. Or it cannot do things that are not to the advantage or are to the disadvantage of the indigenous population. For example, it can build a power plant, yes, but it cannot build a factory that produces hazardous waste to the population. Or in the case of the settlements, it cannot build settlements that actually release their sewage water on Palestinian land. This is, again, you are hurting the indigenous population, and hence Israel is violating international law by doing so. Another thing that we need to point out here is that Israel also is violating international law, because also international law specifically says, and that's the fourth Geneva Convention, it says that the occupying power shall not transfer part of its civilian population into the occupied territories. This is categorical. It just cannot. Okay? This law came because of the experience of the Second World War, where the Nazis actually went ahead by transferring Jews from Poland or from Eastern Europe, sending them some other places and bringing Germans and settling them in the houses of Jews in those areas. So this law was specifically put so that any nation cannot do anything in order to change the demographic of the situation. And this is very important, because what happens, if you allow this to happen, you'll have generation after generation of people being born in this occupied territory. And hence it becomes really difficult and maybe in a sense even unjust to tell these people that were born in occupied territory, well, you don't belong there. And this is very important to fight, because this is how conflicts become primordial, I might say, because you would have people that had nothing to do with the occupation. They were born there, but they didn't come there. Okay, I can quote one of the little girls in Kfar Darom settlement in Gaza in the beginning of Intifada, and she was a victim of a bus attack on a bus that was moving in Gaza Strip from one settlement to the other, and it was attacked by Palestinians. So I think she lost her leg or something, and she told her mother, of course, they're in the settlement. And she says, why did you bring us to Kfar Darom? Did you bring us here to kill us? To have us killed? And this is such a simple sentence. She's just a 10-year-old girl. And she's saying, I had nothing to do with this. Why am I being hurt? I was just born in Kfar Darom. I didn't choose to come to Kfar Darom. I didn't choose to live in an occupied territory. And this is part of the injustice and the wrong that these settlers are doing to their children. They are using them as human shields. They are putting them in precarious situations. They are the ones who are throwing them into danger. The Israelis say that the Palestinian women send their sons and daughters to throw rocks and get killed, and they encourage them to kill themselves in suicide bombs. Well, what are the settlers doing? By simply living in occupied territories, the whole world recognizes that it's not it's illegal to be there, and actually it does recognize that it's the responsibility of the occupying power, that's Israel, for the safety of these people. That is, when the indigenous population attacks those settlers, they are not doing wrong, they are resisting. Because it's the existence of those settlers that consolidates the occupation, and hence, any form of resistance in that sense, according to international law, is legal. And again, when Israelis say, well, they are attacking civilians, well, unfortunately for Israelis, those settlers are not considered civilians also. They might be considered civilians in the eyes of the Israelis, but they are occupiers. It's unfortunate that they are getting the brunt of the occupation, but we didn't bring them there. They came. And that's maybe the sad situation, that many people did not choose to be there. And I'll get into that, about the dynamics of how Israel invites Israelis to live in the settlements by giving them incentives, but that's the second section. Very quickly, I'm going to go through the distribution of settlements. Basically, settlements, what happened is, of course, before 67, it was all Arab land. Some things that people, even Arabs, don't know, there were some settlements that were there before 1948. Some examples are, actually, Kfar Darom. It was there before 1948. It was a kibbutz. You had Neve Yaakov in Jerusalem. You had Gush Etzion. I'm going to say it. Gush Etzion was Kfar Etzion, I'm sorry, Neve Yaakov. You have, I had like three or four others in the West Bank. You have, of course, in Hebron and in the Old City. And you had Kfar Darom in Gaza. So when the 1948 war came, these people were expelled from these settlements and they went into Israel proper. So the Israelis contend, you know, we're only, when they rebuilt those settlements again in 1967, they said we're just reclaiming a land that was rightfully ours, and that's it. Okay, well, excellent. If you're reclaiming a land that was yours, that you were expelled from, well, okay, there are over 450 Palestinian localities in Israel proper in the 1948 areas that the Palestinians were expelled from, that Palestinians have a legal tender showing that it's theirs, and the Israelis are not allowing them to go in. You have two examples of two villages called Ikrit and Bir'im, in which in 1951, the Israeli Supreme Court passed a sentence saying that these people have the right to go back, because the Israeli army that expelled them told them, this is just temporary, and you can come back after the cessation of hostilities. And they got this Supreme Court ruling, and till this day, and that's back in 1951, they're not back. And this is, yeah, it's a ruling of the Supreme Court. So this is, again, part of the hypocrisy and double standards that the Israeli play around with. They claim that they are just repatriating these Jews into Eretz Israel while denying the Palestinians the same right. Well, this is the case of those small or few settlements, less than 10 settlements that were in the 1967 areas. All the other settlements, which number actually above 280 settlements, these are were all new. It was all acquired through either direct confiscation or from buying land from Palestinians. And again, this is also not legal, contrary to popular belief. Even when the occupier buys land from the occupied indigenous population, this can also be challenged in the international courts in the same sense that you challenge blackmail or extortion, exactly. It's like getting information under torture. It's like it comes under duress. So the Palestinian can always claim that since I'm under occupation, I'm not totally free, and hence when I sold this land, I wasn't in my full liberty to do so. I'm under occupation. I'm intimidated. I don't dare not buy, sell it because I don't know what the Israelis might do to me. And hence, even those areas, because the Israelis keep claiming, no, we bought this land and we got along very well with the Palestinians and all that, even that can be challenged. In a nutshell, all settlements are illegal, full stop. It's the law. It's just the law. Okay? Now, these settlements, again, one of the misinformation, again, and it goes around, is that there are 140 settlements. That's not true. Satellite images show that you have at least 280 Israeli built-up areas, and I'm not counting military bases because these are another further 100, okay, in the Palestinian areas. What the Israelis do is that you'd have like three or four built-up Israeli built-up areas, caravans or houses or huts, okay, and they would consider all six or seven of them as one settlement. In one case, Itamar, just east of Nablus, the settlement is like there, and you have five outposts just to the east of it. One of them is like 7 kilometers east of the settlement, and the Israelis still consider it as a neighborhood of Itamar. It's just five sets of hilltops, you know. So what they do is that they just grab these hilltops, okay, and then they grow inwards. And this is the tactic that they have been using. And actually, it was during the Oslo process that all this active settlement building was going on. The settlers were like in a fury, in a commotion of trying to build as many settlements and getting as many outposts as possible. In some cases, they would just put a caravan there and nobody would be living there, and they would claim it's a settlement just so that they grab the land. There was this huge land grab going on within those 7 years. As a matter of fact, in the 7 years of or 8 years of the Oslo process, The settlements doubled in size and doubled in population. They went from the total area of the settlements back in the 1991, it was 75 square kilometers, and by 1999 they went to 150 square kilometers. Okay, they doubled in size. Okay, and one thing that we need to know here is that this is the size that you see on the satellite image, okay? That's not the size that the Israelis claim is the size of the settlement, because they have master plans for these settlements that are much larger than what appears. For the example of Itamar was like this. And when the Palestinians during the negotiations contended that, okay, if this is Itamar, how come these five outposts are there? They're illegal. You built them after the Oslo process. They said, no, well, actually, the master plan of Itamar extends this way. And that's seven times the size of actual Itamar. The master plan of Itamar, that's what the Israelis claim, is seven times as big as Itamar. So again, this is another way in which the Israelis go about getting their way by using legal means, what they call legal, but actually they are legalistic. The legal means of doing an illegal act. Another thing is the population. The population of the settlements, the number that's been going on is that there are 200,000 settlers. That's not true. There are 400,000 settlers. Why is that? Because the Israelis and the Israeli sources do not consider the settlements in East Jerusalem as settlements. We need to go back a bit, in history. In 1967, what happened is that this area was occupied. Okay, was still under Jordanian rule. When the Israelis came in 1967, the first thing they did like 2 weeks after the end of hostilities, they annexed 70 square kilometers of the West Bank and considered it part of the municipality of West Jerusalem. So according to Israel, this area is not West Bank. This is Israel proper. Okay, and here we need to explain some legal aspects of this. Again, according to international law, an occupier is not allowed, okay, to annex any land, and hence it's not allowed to apply its own laws on those occupied territories. What the occupier has to do is to keep using the same laws that were in that land before it occupied it, and if necessary, use military laws. So how does Israel go about doing this? What it considered all the West, because it didn't annex the West Bank, it used Jordanian and Ottoman and British laws, along with around 1,500 military laws, in order to rule in the West Bank. Okay, so these are the laws applicable in the West Bank. But in East Jerusalem, it's applying Israeli law, and that's illegal because it's not supposed to. It's occupied land; you're not supposed to do that. One thing they do with this law is that, again, they use it to their advantage. They look like they're very legalistic, you know, we're abiding by the law, we're not applying our laws in the West Bank, we are applying Ottoman and Jordanian laws. Well, what do? They use it to their advantage again. Because the Jordanian and British laws were like obsolete laws, they were back in the 50s and early 60s, they did not have a good fair labor right laws, or environmental laws for that. There were no environmental laws back in the 50s, or health laws. Those have to do with the health of the laborers. So what happened is that Israel said, okay, no, we cannot apply our own law here. So what they do is that they have these industrial areas, around 7 industrial areas in the West Bank, in which Israeli law, which is pretty progressive and has a lot of rights for the laborers, a lot of health restrictions, a lot of environmental restrictions on industry, well, they don't apply in the West Bank. So the Israeli entrepreneur has an incentive. Okay, I'll go build it here because here the law does not apply. I can abuse my laborers, I can abuse the environment, I can abuse the transgress the health of my my workers because it's all legal there. The health laws and the environmental laws and the labor laws do not apply in the West Bank. And hence this great incentive. That's why settlement products are genuinely evil, because when you're buying a settlement product, you are hurting the environment, you are hurting the rights of those abused Palestinian labor, and you're hurting their health too. You had several cases. There is a very famous industrial area here called Barqan, close to Nablus, between Nablus and Salfit, and you have high cases of asthma in Salfit because you have asbestos and many chemical factories there that if they were in Israel, I mean, the guy would have gone to jail because of what he did. But since it's in the West Bank, Israeli law does not apply, so they get away with it. That's why this occupation is so evil. That's why we need to get rid of it at any cost. And it's a case for all people that are concerned with the environment and with labor laws and with health laws. This is a genuine human humanitarian fight and struggle. Another thing also that I need to talk about was the growth of the settlements. A common farce that the Israelis have been spreading around is that the growth of settlements is just to cater for natural growth. One small thing that I need to allude to is the fact that in the Oslo agreements and all the agreements that followed, there were always preambles and texts that or articles that refer to the fact that since the Oslo agreement has a 5-year interim period and then a final stages period, it was agreed by both sides that in this interim period, both sides will not do anything or not take any action that would prejudice the final status solution. They won't do anything on the ground that would change the status quo. Okay? Now, according to the Israelis, this translates that the Palestinians would not claim independence. That's what it's supposed to mean. And according to us, it's supposed to mean that Israel is not allowed to do changes on the ground that would make the final status solution prejudice, mainly the settlements. They're not allowed to expand them and have like blocks here and blocks there and continue expropriating land, uprooting trees and demolishing houses, changing practically on the ground changing the demographics on the ground. The West Bank, if you see the satellite image, you see the image of 1990 and you see the image of 2000, they are two different images. It's not the same. And you have facts on the ground that the Israelis are getting away with. They're not allowed to do that. So back to the topic of growth. So whenever the Palestinians would challenge the Israelis, you know, how come you are breaching the agreement? How come you are building all these settlements and you're bringing in those settlers? The Israelis would reply, well, this is only natural growth. We're not changing the status quo. This is just the natural growth of the settlers. Well, I did a study. I used Israeli statistics. I used the Israeli statistical yearbook. And I got the numbers for Israeli growth. Guess what? You find out that from 93 till 98, the natural growth in Israel, okay, in Israel as a whole, Arabs and Jews, it was 2.5% per year. For Jews alone, it was 2%. So they have an annual natural growth of 2%. That's birth and death rate, including immigration. Okay, this is just how their numbers increase. Okay, that's in Israel. When you see the settlements, how they were from 93 till 98, the growth is 8%. That's four times the average of the of Israel as a whole. And in 1 year, it was like 12%. This is not natural growth. You don't multiply a population by 12% and call this natural growth. Even rabbits don't multiply that fast. It's absurd. And they still sell it as natural growth. And the Americans believe that, oh, no, this is natural growth. No, it's not natural. And why is it not natural? Because it's four times the Israeli average. How come those people here are growing this fast? Well, it's the fact that Israel gives incentives for them to grow. And here is a very important point in which I'm going to get to, how, again, Israel uses Israelis as human shields, as pawns in its cynical war against the Palestinians, in which it wants to assert its control on the land. What it does is this. Settlers get the settlements get preferential treatment in the sense that they are considered, high priority housing areas. That is, they get special tax cuts, they get grants to help out or gives incentives for people to build houses and contractors to build houses in these settlements. So what happens is that they get people who go to the settlement or choose to rent or buy a house in the settlement, they get like 7% tax deductions. They get easy loans that are like 20 and 30 year loans. In some cases, they had like 80% or 70% of the value of the house as a grant, as an actual grant. So you have all these incentives to go and live there. In some cases, in Bethlehem, for example, an apartment in Bethlehem, in a Bethlehem settlement, of course, would cost one-fourth of what it would cost if it were in West Jerusalem. So what would happen is that an average Israeli would say, okay, I would accept, because Jerusalem can be very attractive for many people to go there because it's the center, they would go and work in Jerusalem at a low wage, okay, and go live in a Bethlehem settlement. They can't afford to live like that because the settlement is so subsidized by the state of Israel that they manage to keep this low-wage labor and live in Bethlehem. So he's having a wonderful life. He's fine. He can even have some savings. And he's happy. Now, what happens is the Intifada breaks out. The Israelis, some settlers want to get out of the settlements. Some put it at around 30% of the settlers. I'll get back to this number again. They want to get out of the settlement, but they can't afford it. With the money they're making, they cannot afford to move into Israel. They can only afford a house in a settlement. That's their income, what their income puts them in. So now they're incarcerated in the settlements. They are being used as human shields. Their living in Bethlehem as settlers was made possible by the state of Israel. So the state of Israel is responsible for them. If they feel insecure and they cannot move back to where it's safe for them, they would say it's Israel's responsibility. It's not the Palestinian responsibility. All those settlers that are saying that they're in Efrat settlement that's just south of Bethlehem and that they're not safe and all of that, but it's not my problem. It's your country's problem because it got you there. Just to refer about the reason why settlers are there, before the Intifada in 1999, there was a study that was made, and it showed that around 30%, over 30% of the settlers there are there for economic reasons, and that their answer for the question that would you leave the settlement and resettle in 1948 areas if you're given the proper economic incentive, they said yes. So around 30% of the settlers are there for economic reasons, then 30% are there for religious or principal reasons, and the 60% others are like mixed. I would like to just see if there's anything else I want to say. Well, basically is that the settlements, and the case of the settlements is just one example of how Israel gets away with breaking the law. And this is what we need our fight to make it about. It's about being legal. We're after Pinochet because Pinochet was torturing people. He hijacked a whole state. We are against Sharon because he's violating international law. We cannot allow this to happen. Because if we allow it to happen, we'll allow the Srebrenica massacres, we allow the things that have been happening in Rwanda, and we'll be allowing more and more evil. It's up to us to stand up, not because we're pro-Israel or against Israel, not because we're pro-Palestinian or against Palestinians, it's because we're for what's right and against what's wrong. When somebody does wrong, if it was Mother Teresa, I would be against her. No matter how nice Mother Teresa, God rest her soul in peace, if she's living in my house, she's a settler. I don't care how nice she is. She's breaking the law. No matter who breaks the law, we need to uphold the law. And this is a universal principle. Just as much as America, when it resigned the Kyoto Agreement and the International Ballistic Missile Treatment, we are against the states when it does that because it's breaking the law. It takes a lot of time, it took a lot of effort and a lot of wars to make the Fourth Geneva Convention, to make international law and humanitarian law. It doesn't come from a vacuum. It came from people that paid the price and they paid their lives to make these laws possible. The labor laws, the health laws, the women laws, the blacks and whites laws. They came from people that stood up and said, no, this is not right and we're standing against it. And this is what the case of Palestine. There are international law. What we want is these international laws to be applied. Israel is not above the law.
Okay. Well, thanks, Nizar. That was I think that showed us just why why we're here and. I think gave a good background to what I think we're going to get into after our next two speakers, which is what we're going to do about what's going on and how we're going to make Israel and the U.S. obey those standards of international law that we all agree with and all want to see upheld there.